In a world completely overrun by inane media, there are podcasts that rise above the rest. This is not one of those. Two middle-aged white guys from Middle America talk about random shit for about an hour or so. This is the Magical Talking Hat.
Okay. We're good. I thought I had to burp for a second.
Boy, I'm glad you didn't have to burp.
I still think I have to burp. Okay, anyway. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the mystery episode of the Magical Talking Hat. How does he come up with these?
I don't know.
The only podcast that might have to burp later. I'm Tony.
And I'm William.
And who knows what episode number this is?
We don't know.
It's a mystery. We don't have numbers in our world.
They just tell us to do it, and we do it, which I don't know why. It must be the hat.
$10 is $10.
Well, I know, but really?
Yeah.
I mean...
I know. So here we are. So, there's not much to say. So, thanks for coming.
Yeah.
For those of you new to this deal... because I'm sure that happens. There's a magical hat. It is magical in that it checks its own email and spits out those emails as little cards out of itself. Kind of disgusting when you think about it.
Yeah, really.
And we, or sometimes our other dimensional counterparts, draw those out at random, and those are usually things from you guys, the listeners. Questions, topics, that kind of stuff, and we talk about them till we're bored. That's the show, and that's the magic. So that's it. You got anything exciting to talk about beforehand?
No, not really. I suppose we should clarify. The guys that usually do this, you know, they
don't have goatees.
They don't have goatees. They can't see. I keep forgetting they can't see us.
No.
And so a mystery episode is what they call it when they can't make it, whatever, to record. There's bad weather or someone's sick, and then we take over.
Yeah.
So if you're hearing us, it means something's happened to the guys over there that has prevented them from
recording.
They're
dead, basically, is what we're saying.
Probably not. I mean, we always hope that happens, but it never does.
Because we're evil. We're the evil versions, in case people didn't know.
That's right.
That.
We're the evil versions, but that's not the only reason we hope they're dead. Because example, if they die, then we don't have to do this anymore.
Or do we have to do it every week?
Oh, crap. Yeah, I hope they don't die. Yeah. Man.
Yeah, no, we're the evil versions. For instance, William, as we have established before, will take pennies and not leave pennies.
Yeah, at the convenience stores.
Other William will never do that.
Nope.
Because
he's a...
And I...
He's a wimp.
My evil version is pretty similar to where there's not a broad gap.
Really?
Because from what I can gather, I start off pretty evil.
Oh, okay.
So just a little more oomph, you know?
Well, wait a minute. Maybe on this dimension you're a little good, maybe. To be opposite.
I don't feel like that's right.
I don't either, but I was just saying.
And what am I doing with this goatee over the top of my full beard?
Otherwise? I don't know. That's true. That's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah. All right. So, I should probably stop sticking my fingers in my mouth while I'm recording an audio podcast. All right, let's do this hat thing.
All right, let's do it.
But in all dimensions, William always draws the first thing out of the hat.
Is that right? I didn't know they did it that way over there.
What's it say?
It's our favorite Kia.
Oh, it's our favorite Kia.
Kia B.
Kia B.
Dear the Magical
Talking Hat. If we ever get another Kia, this is going to get awkward.
Yeah. Dear the Magical Talking Hat. Swiping your child's own Halloween candy, parental privilege, or just plain mean? wow, she's asking the right people, because, of course, over here, you always swipe your child's online key.
Yes, that's
just how it is.
I always find this interesting concept because I believe it is fairly universal. Parents take some of their kids' Halloween candy. And the levels of different explanations, rationalizations, guilt, like, it's tremendous. Some parents don't even bother. They're just like, give me some candy. I'm like, why? It's mine. It's like, no, you went around. I took it out. Give me some damn candy. I'm your parents. And that's why. Shut up. Give you something to trick or treat about.
Yeah.
Or I don't even know what that means. But and others do the things where they're like, oh, I need to inspect it, which is a legitimate thing. You got to make sure nobody stuck nails in the Snickers or whatever. But sometimes they will use that to, like, take some. Like, oh, this one's suspicious. You know, or they will decide. I've seen this before. The parent will decide that there is a particular variety of candy that the kid does not like. And this is sometimes news to the kid. They say, oh, no, I'm going to take all of your Reese's because you hate Reese's.
You've really got this down. I have all this information.
I have seen a lot of parents do this with their kids.
Wow.
I have been witness to many trick-or-treaters. I was involved. I trick-or-treated for a very long time with a variety of people. When I was older, I took other siblings, my friends' younger siblings trick-or-treating as an excuse to keep going trick-or-treating. So, I've seen a lot of this action here. I mean, only you can know deep in your heart if you're just being mean and stealing, but I feel like it is very rare that a kid gets less than a ridiculous amount of candy for them.
So you're not really taking anything away, really.
I feel like there's always a surplus. I do find interesting the different tools of rationing.
Yeah, yes, yes.
Because some are the, you can have X amount now, Y amount later, you know, we stretch it out over time. Then there's ones that you can eat as much as you want up until this point, and whatever's left we get rid of. Things like this.
Well, we had an interesting thing going on in the household that I live in, where there were young children for a while. One of the kids was allergic to just about every candy that he got.
Yes.
So there had to be a lot of sorting involved, and the other kids who weren't allergic were very gracious about trading up, you know, trading around. Like, well,
if they had something he wasn't allergic to, they would find a way to get it.
Very good about. We didn't have to like make them do that or anything.
What was he not allergic to? Because I know the kind of things he was allergic to.
Right.
So what was
it? It's hard because it's funny the things people put dairy in, but there's a lot of candies that don't have any dairy in them. I mean, most chocolate candies, of course, did, and some, non-chocolate candies
did too.
Which is really weird, but there were a lot of candies.
Because I remember, like, Starburst ended up having them.
Something like that, yeah. So there was a lot of things like that we had to worry about. Also, for a while, they went to a dentist who would buy their candy. They could get cash for it.
Oh, that's an interesting, creepy level of things. Wonder what he did with the candy.
The dentist, sorry, that was
a terrible assumption.
She threw it away, I think. She destroyed it, I think.
Interesting.
But
that's weird.
But as I recall, we often did benefit from the boon somehow, and I don't remember us just taking it. I don't think we did that. But the kids would sometimes give it to us, or we would ask, say, hey, you know, can I have a candy bar or whatever? And, oh, sure, you know. So that was never really much of an issue in our house.
I'm sure my folks ate some of my candy. It didn't stick with me, whatever happened.
Well, and that's another thing is I don't remember my parents having any of my candy at all. Maybe they did, but I don't remember that.
But to be fair, you earned your candy. Where you lived, it was a 5-mile hike each way to get a piece from the neighbors.
No, see, the thing about where I lived in candy is We happened to live in a place where there weren't a whole lot of kids. Mm-hmm. And there were some people who were older people, and the kids were a little scared of them. So they wouldn't go to their house. But we would, because they were friends with my grandmother, and we lived in my grandmother's house. So, you know, we'd go to their house, and no other kids had visited there, so they'd basically just give us everything that they got.
I see.
Now, that said, my parents were very careful not to... We never had big bags of candy. I mean, my parents, they knew how much candy they thought we needed, and if we went to three houses and got that amount, that's three houses
is what
we went to.
Right. You're getting this much candy, not you're going to this many houses.
Right, right.
Interesting.
Now, with the kids that lived in the house, you know, that I've been living in now, we would do a similar thing. There would be certain neighborhoods we'd visit, and we might not go to this neighborhood over here if the neighborhood we just went to, you know, had enough of a haul
crazy.
That we didn't feel like they needed a whole lot of sugar and candy. And sometimes we've, you know, if the kids were eating a lot of candy one day and we were worried about them eating so much candy, we would say something about it. The fact of the matter is, none of the, most of the checkups at these.
Excuse me, Jim.
You all right?
Wow, that's going to be fun for people. There's a big
spike. Most of the checkups at the dentist that these kids have had, no cavities. I mean, so that was kind of the way this household was run in terms of candy or whatever, But let me just say this about parental privilege. This is something that in general, I think is very different from when I was growing up, parental privilege. I mean, my parents, I don't think, were interested in candy, so they didn't eat any of our candy that I know of. But if my parents wanted any of my candy, they were going to get my candy.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was it. And there wasn't even going to be a feeling on my part like, oh, this isn't fair or whatever, because it's like, well, they're the parents, so
yeah.
They want it, they get it. That it never occurred to me to think that I had rights or that they didn't have the right to do what they were doing. It just never occurred to me that way. And not because I was stupid, I didn't understand rights, but because when I was growing up, this was the parental right. I mean, the parent had the right to do whatever the parent felt was necessary for the good of the kid. And if you were the kid, maybe you don't like it, but you're not the parent either. I mean, maybe you don't know why the parent's doing it. And sometimes you could ask without getting punished for it. And sometimes you couldn't. But sometimes the only answer you're going to get was because I said so, and you just had to live with it.
Yeah, I think that was a common thing in as I call it, the olden times.
Well, and it bred a lot of resentment with some kids, but for some kids it was like, well, they're the parents. Of course they're going to be.
Well, and I was weird. I grew up in a time when that was the common thing. That was not how it was in my household.
Well, it wasn't.
It was very rare that somebody would pull the because I said so. And if they did, man, would I pitch a fit. I was raised by people who worked really hard to explain everything to me.
Yeah.
And consequently, if they didn't, or if it seemed arbitrary to me, I would lose my shit.
Well, in our household, With the kids I was just talking about earlier, we did explain everything. We never said because I said so, because that just didn't seem right to us. Why shouldn't the kid know? So we would explain things, and after a while, the kids would lose it, not because they thought it was wrong or arbitrary, but just because they didn't like it. And sometimes they would engage us in conversations about why, when they knew why, they just wanted to engage us in the conversation to see if they could, you know.
Yeah.
Slip us up or whatever. So that kind of backfired after a while. But no, when I was growing up, there were times where, you know, for a long time I didn't understand the because I said so routine, and I didn't like it. When I got older, I understood it more. I understood that what it meant was, you know, it was about respecting authority and things like that. Although I even though I understood it and I accepted that's why my parents were doing it, I didn't like it, and I vowed that I wasn't going to do that when I had kids, because I thought that was the wrong way to go about it. But still, I do think that, you know, today there is such a thing in sociology called the parental relationship, where there's a and this doesn't just apply to parents and kids, but it also applies to teachers and students. And there's this kind of relationship where one person is teaching the other, and the person being taught, you know, needs to have a modicum of respect and understanding toward the mentor or whatever, to understand that sometimes when that mentor does something, they might not fully understand it, but they have to trust what that mentor is doing. And the mentor, being a mentor, has to sometimes make the hard decision, say no sometimes, and stick with that decision and explain it maybe to the person as best they can, and if they don't understand it, hope they'll understand it later. There's a lot of complex things going on in that relationship, and these days, it seems like parents, our culture doesn't want parents to be parents. You know, there has to be, like, a child. Well, one way that someone explained it to me once back where we worked, you know, you and I worked together at a...
I did know that.
At that yes. computer place. Yes. Someone there explained it to me that a lot of kids these days think they're guests in their own house. And they don't understand that the house they live in is also a little bit their house, their home. That the family is a unit that they're a part of, and that they have something to do. They have a role to play in that. But no, they don't think about it that way. They think that they're a guest in this house. So either they don't have to do anything toward keeping the house up or helping the family, whatever, unless they get something out of, like, an allowance or pay or a bribe or whatever.
Yeah.
Now, again, when I was growing up, you know, when you were asked to do something, it wasn't simply the authority of the parents and fear of being punished. It was you understood that you belonged to this unit called a family, and that this house was all of yours together, and you understood that this was all part of what you were doing together. You didn't feel like a guest in your house.
Yeah.
But this person explained to me, and I think she was right, that a lot of kids these days feel like that, and that you know. Well, the kids that were growing up that I was helping raise, they started to wonder why they weren't guests in their house and got a little resentful. So it's kind of a thing that spreads all over, and I don't think that's a very good thing. I think there is such a thing as parental privilege, or should be, and when that goes away and the parental relationship starts to diminish in families where there should be a parental relationship, I think our culture is kind of going in a wrong direction, and the children who need parents, I mean, maybe not necessarily the nuclear family parents or whatever, but, you know, they need somebody to teach them. They're lacking that at a critical time in their life, and kids can't raise themselves. Sorry. The kids by themselves or with their peer group, they need guidance. They need a parental relationship with somebody or some group of people, or it takes a village, whatever. I don't care how you say it. If kids reach a certain age and in our culture they're kind of on their own and parents can't do anything to help them or to lead them, then I think our culture's in really big trouble. But maybe that's a ridiculous way to take this question. But
well, she asked it.
This is the show.
I less about Halloween candy.
Well, it's something I worry about, though.
Yeah,
I mean,
I feel like I was raised different from either of those models. Closer to the model you disapprove of. And I will admit, I have very serious issues with respecting authority. Always have. I feel like I have very good issues with respecting people, however.
Okay, well... And
I feel like that came from my parents.
No, I agree.
And I feel like that is something lacking in a modern model. Because I don't have a lot of respect for you are in a position of authority over me. I have a lot of respect for you are a person who is just as important as I am.
That's right. And this is something that actually with these children I was speaking of before, we also had, you know, we didn't want them to... That's one of the reasons we wanted to explain everything to them, was because we didn't want them to have this, oh, you're an authority, well, I'm going to do what you say. We did not want that at all. And we wanted just what you said, to respect people as people, you know, not as authorities or whatever. But there's, that's an important element to add there, is the whole respecting people thing. Because you can,
well, including your parents.
Exactly.
You don't have to respect them as authority figures to respect them as individuals. And the whole living as a guest in your own house is part of that. Because they're people, and they are just as entitled as you are to the benefits of the household. And, I mean, yeah, you do your... Like you said, you do your part because you're part of the house.
Right, right.
Not because they're making you.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. And that's, but see, that's,
and that was the stuff I wouldn't in general fight over. I usually, the biggest fight that I remember having was with my father. I would frequently have fights, and he was raised in much more of a parental authority thing. Mm-hmm. And there were two bits. One that bothered him a lot was one's tone, regardless of what one was saying.
Yeah, yeah.
And this drove me crazy. Nowadays, I understand. I still don't necessarily approve of how he handled that.
Right.
But at the time, I was completely self-deluded about it, and so I thought he was just being an asshole. I now understand what he meant.
Mm-hmm.
But the other one, and I still hold to this one today, is the best example I can give for this always is, and I may be getting the details wrong, but basically, I was taking piano lessons for a while, and I had to have my practicing, I had a set amount of practicing, had to be done by 4:30 on Friday. I was notorious for waiting till the last minute, but I did it. I just frequently would do it at, you know, like 3 on Friday. And so there's a Thursday afternoon, and I was bugging my dad because I wasn't really doing anything. He says, "You're not doing anything. Practice your piano." And I was like, "No, I got till 4:30 on Friday." He's like, "No, I told you, go do it now." And I would lose my mind over that one. And to this day, I still hold to that. If you're going to set a specific boundary, you have to be consistent.
No,
about it.
And that's right. But remember,
and that was a common one with him.
Yeah,
is if he wanted something, and there may have been a good reason for it, but he had established where the boundaries were, and to change them, I would get in huge fights with my parents, not even over the thing. There was some, I still don't even remember the details. It involved feeding the dog. And it wasn't me not wanting to feed the dog. And I told him at the time, it was the principle of it. I don't even remember what it was now, but it was something about certain assumptions that I thought were not fair.
But keep in mind that there is something in sociology also called the authority relationship, and the parental relationship is not the authority relationship. The parental relationship is not about authority. There's also the tyrannical relationship, which I think everyone can figure out what that is. The parental relationship...
It's when you... A human and a dinosaur?
No, the parental relationship, again, just think of the fact that you could the parental relationship can also pertain to a mentor and an apprentice, for example, or a teacher and a student. It's a teacher, you know, doesn't really have authority in the sense of, say, a boss. And this is why we never said to the kids, "Because I told you so," because this wasn't what we thought the parental relationship was about. It wasn't about authority. It wasn't about you obey me. Obedience was not a thing in our house at all. In fact, the term obedience, we didn't really even like that. We didn't want the kids to obey anybody or anything. It wasn't about obedience. It was about you think things through. Like you said, you have respect for other people. You care about other people. All of these values that can guide your behavior, and if you have these values, you don't need concepts like obedience or even loyalty. We didn't like that concept very much either, because it just seemed like a kind of obedience, you know, where you kind of blindly follow something because of this principle called loyalty. We didn't want the kids to do anything blind like that, and the parental relationship doesn't really entail all that kind of authority. The parental relationship is about guidance, and it's about helping the child or the student or whatever gain a greater amount of autonomy. The parent's job is to eliminate the parent's job, basically, over time. And that there's really no place for bossing kids around or treating kids like they're subordinates in that situation, as far as we could tell and how we parented. And my parents didn't parent that much, except on very... specific rare occasions where they pulled the whole "well, because I told you so" routine.
Yeah.
And so that's how we raised the kids, and, you know, three kids. I would say that we were terribly successful for a lot of reasons that I won't get into, but I don't regret how we went about things. I mean, I think we did things correctly, and the fact that that some things didn't work out, I don't really take as being our fault. I mean, we weren't perfect. We made mistakes, but...
You always screw up your kids. You just if you're lucky, you get to work on which ways you screw them up.
Well, that's true. But also, you know, kids make choices too. I mean, there comes a point where a person, no matter how they were raised, no matter what their culture has taught them, no matter what their parents have taught them, they have to say, well, what kind of person am I going to be?
Yeah.
And that choice is entirely theirs. And really, the parent has almost nothing to do with that. I mean, they can impact what those choices look like to the kid. And they maybe can make it a little easier to choose, you know, X rather than Y. But it's the kid can choose whatever he or she wants, and there's very little that a parent can do about it. All the parent can do is prepare the way and answer the kid's questions and try to help the kid reach the goals that the kid, him or herself, says that he or she has, and just hope for the best. And then after that, you've just kind of got to let it go.
My goal was to become a zebra.
Well, the point being,
I did not succeed.
There's a lot of. I think the parental relationship is so misunderstood in our culture that people go to extremes. Either they don't parent at all, or, well, both ways they don't parent at all. One way they don't do anything, and the other way they do too much. Helicopter parents, they call them, and stuff like that. And I don't. I'm not really sure how this has come about.
This is why I like cats, because I can totally manipulate them and people don't care nearly so much. I don't have no kids. This is why I don't have no kids. I don't like this shit.
You don't?
I don't have any kids. Why? No, did you think I
what, you don't like it. What do you mean you don't like thinking about it?
I think the decisions are too difficult. I would not like to have to live with those.
Well, when I was...
Because you're going to screw them up. And I know. You always
have to feel weird about that.
I
probably told you this before. I remember in first grade when a kid... opened a first grade classroom, and there was a closet door, and a kid walked up and opened it to see what was inside. And the teacher punished him as if he'd done it just out of defiance, not because he was curious to know what was behind the closet door.
Was there any rule about...
Apparently.
But nobody was aware of this rule?
Well, I hadn't been. Okay. I mean, I remember watching the kid get punished for something that I didn't even think the kid would have known, like you said, the rule. And I remember thinking, boy, that's not very, you know, I'm not gonna be that way with my kids. If my kid does something, I'm gonna try to understand the reason and the motivation, and I'm not gonna go punish the kid for doing something that he didn't know he was doing.
The producer and I have noted with pleasure that the neighbor kids have something that most kids we see do not have. If they are doing something dangerous and we say that's not safe, they pretty much always stop without argument. They understand the concept of safety, and they trust us and their parents enough that if we say that is not safe, they know that means they could hurt themselves.
That's good.
And it works very well, and a lot of kids don't have it. And the producer and I have discovered this because we have encountered other children who we have attempted to stop doing something by saying, that's not safe. That has not worked.
Yeah, well...
Then we had to raise our voices to them.
Yeah. Well, the point I was making in the previous story...
Oh, sorry. I thought the coming out of the closet story was done. I apologize.
No, the story was done, but I was just trying to say... I've been thinking about these things for a long time is what I'm getting at. You know, for as long as I can remember, I've thought about how parents do this and that doesn't work very well, and parents do that and that does work okay. So for me, you know, that's what I wanted to be as a parent, probably more than anything else in the world. So to me, these topics are very interesting, and I like to think about them. And I think that's very fascinating what you said about the kids next door, because sometimes kids have a perfectly good concept of what's safe, but you tell them it's not safe, and all you're telling them is, oh, this might be fun.
Yeah.
Maybe this is something I want to do.
Well, and as they get older, that may be a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But, and they have the occasional life lesson in this thing, because sometimes they forget, or sometimes we haven't mentioned that specific thing is unsafe, and they do it, and we say, see, that's not safe, as they're bleeding from the skull,
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah.
And I've seen the neighbors make mistakes, instant mistakes. I have seen them do things as parents that they immediately regret how they handled it.
Yeah.
But it was a sudden thing. And I can see myself doing that. And Yeah, it's a minefield.
Well, it is.
I find it interesting. I'm so glad I'm not involved.
It is, but it's, I don't know. So to you, all that complexity means stay away from it. Whereas for me, it's like, well, this seems like an important thing to do, and I want to try it.
See, that's how I feel about drugs and alcohol. See, this is why we're different.
No, but
people.
Drugs and alcohol aren't complicated. They're very easy to understand, and then you okay. Well,
chemically speaking, there's a lot going on there.
Not very interesting,
there's
actually.
Neural receptors. It's fascinating stuff.
I'm grateful for the opportunity. Since I didn't have kids of my own, I'm grateful for the opportunity to have been involved in the lives of kids who. You know, I knew them ever since they were infants, I was always a part of their life. And, you know, I wish it had gone better, but I go back and do everything, you know, the same. I'd correct a few things that I wish I hadn't done, but, I mean, as far as being there and, you know, just the broad strokes of the things I did, I would do it all the same.
Well, if I find some spare kids, I'll send them your way.
Well.
You want a cat?
No, it's not really the same.
I know, but I just want to get rid of this cat.
You don't think that when you get a little older, you'll wish maybe you'd done, had kids? And
no, it's a complicated issue. I will always be of two minds about it.
As most people are.
Since the decision, primarily I've seen things that just make me feel better about it.
Yeah.
The stuff that is important to me, the stuff that I believe, it works better this way.
Yeah.
I'm sure I would have loved having a kid. But no, I think this. I like this.
Okay.
All right. Next.
Well, people pretty much usually get, you know. Oh, well, I guess it's your turn, isn't it? They get what they want. I mean, if you want kids, you get them, and if you don't, a lot of times.
A lot of ones get them that don't want
them. That's true. Although they're not trying very hard not to get him, if that's the case. Less
than, yeah. All right. Craig. Craig, the Scotsman displaced to Slough, or might be in Africa at the moment. I lose track. He's been in some places. This is not dissimilar from other questions we have had in the past. Craig asks, which historical period would you most like to visit? And I think we've discussed this, and I think we've sort of fallen on the side of not even really wanting to.
Yeah,
so
much.
Let me mix this up a little bit.
Okay.
You're gonna go, but you're gonna be the whole was Whitman's invisible eye thing or whatever. You can go and you can see, fly on the wall kind of thing. You're not gonna interact, you're not gonna change anything. You just wanna see what it was really like as opposed to what, you know, articles and movies and stuff tell you it was like.
Well, if that's the case, I can't think of a period that I wouldn't want to see.
I know, but you only get one. This is the, yeah.
I just don't know. There's too many. Too many.
Well, let's leave out any specific, you don't get to go see any exciting events specifically. This is just normal life.
That's exactly it, though. I mean, especially when you study genealogy and you're just dying to know, gosh, what was it like for my ancestors who lived in this place in this time and how much it changed? I mean, you can go back in some genealogies, you can go back, you know, 500 years. That's pretty dramatic.
Yeah.
And then, even if you can't know who those people were or where they lived, you know that, you know, if you go back 80,000 years and people are just leaving Africa. How exciting would that be to see that?
Prehistory. We said historical time period.
Come on. It's all so very interesting and exciting. To pick one would almost be
yeah, it's sort of
tragic.
Anything far enough back that I feel like society didn't resemble what it does now. I mean, yes, it would be awesome to go back and look at the 70s or the 50s or, you know, but further, like at least back to like the early 19th century when I feel like people just interacted differently. Because I want to know what that looked like.
Well, if it, I would priority probably would go to periods that nobody knows about. I mean, you know, nobody's written about it. Nobody has any theories about it. We can't even guess what people were doing back then, really. I mean, we can guess, but that's all something like that. I mean, would probably take priority over a time period where we have quite a bit of knowledge about it. And we can, you know, people have made TV shows and movies that are period pieces where their people are living then. You get the idea that it's probably pretty close to that. You know, something that people just completely have to pull it out of the air to tell you what it was like. I would probably put priority on those epics, but I don't know. It's hard to say. You know, I'd really like to know what tribal Europe was like, because for a long time Europe was tribal, just like lots of other places. And I think that as a tribal place, it was very similar to other tribal places. And I would like some of the specifics. I'd be curious to know what types of practices there were, what kinds of art, what kinds of music, how they interacted with other tribal groups, how they were influenced by tribal groups further south and further east, you know. Stuff like that I would find really interesting, because we know very little about that, in part because there was a certain point in European history where nobody even wanted to admit that Europeans had once ever, you know, tribal, you know.
I do find that, I will admit, one of the most fascinating things I did study that, like, where I studied it and was pleasantly surprised to find out there was lots more to it, was pre-Roman and early Roman Celtic society, mm-hmm. when it was still in these tribes and these clans. Mm-hmm. And it really was very fascinating and way more robust than I had realized. Mm-hmm. The level of art and culture was way beyond what I expected.
Well, in Germanic tribes too, and some of the tribes that held out longest against being Christianized were German or Germanic, I should say. So, yeah, a lot of interesting things there, and I think that it's valuable to think about and to study, because, as I said, you know, for a long time European culture, Western culture maybe in general, had such disdain for anything tribal. You know, it was savage, it was barbarian, mm-hmm. and they really disconnected themselves from that part of their own heritage. So there's very little left of it to look at or to investigate or to even to excavate. And what they do find is really hard to interpret and piece together, because, you know, there's so many missing links that they'll never get back because they just suppressed it or denied it for so long. I think the more they find, the more they realize that, you know, tribal Europeans were in many ways not any different than, you know, tribal Africans, tribal Eurasians, tribal North Americans, tribal South Americans, no different in terms of, you know, a lot of them were animistic in their beliefs. Shamanism was probably widely practiced. You know, animal imagery was important, you know, a lot of things that very similar to tribal people throughout the world. And I find that very interesting and fascinating. And I think that that's one place I might go, but gosh, then as soon as after I'm done being there, I'd want to go further back probably.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff like the early, like Hellenic period and stuff sounds very interesting to me. I feel like there are too many of them that I find interesting that I would eventually just be disappointed in. There are so many where it's like our historical knowledge is largely of the upper elite of society.
Yes, that's right.
And I feel like far too many historical time periods I'd go back to and find that almost everyone is living dirt poor. They get up, they work, they eat, they sleep, that's it. And it would be really depressing.
Well, one place that I really would like to visit is the library and the museum in Alexandria. I'm not sure what point I'd want to visit, because it's hard to tell in the historical record when...
Well, which Alexandria? There have been
hundreds of them. The famous one where the library was that, you know, because, you know, there's a point where a lot of volumes were destroyed. The destruction of the library, historians are starting to get a better picture of that, and it's less likely something that happened once, you know, and wiped the whole place out or something. Yeah. That little by little, things happened that made it eventually collapse or go away. And so I'm not sure what time period I'd want to visit there so I could really get a good sense of what the volumes contained. But it would be so cool to know what kinds of things were there that were lost and what the impact of that was, because we just don't even know.
Yeah.
What kinds of things were lost that might have changed history really dramatically. We just don't even know that.
I'm always fascinated by that kind of the stuff that people at the time consider important or not important, and what that means later.
Right.
How many people wrote texts that thought this is going to change the world? And a couple hundred years after that, nobody ever remembered it ever again.
Right. Or what things were like that, and then 300 years later, someone rediscovered it, thinking that they were first discovering it, and it did change the world. And it's like, wow, what kinds of stuff? And the library is, and there's a couple libraries in history like that, not just the one in Alexandria, but this is, you know, this was a project, right? I mean, they didn't just wait for people to show up with books. I mean, they wanted this to be a repository of all the knowledge of the known world. So they went out and looked for stuff and encouraged people to put things in it. So when you look at what's in that library, and from all over the world, and not in North and South America, of course, but all over not just Europe, but further east and in Northern Africa and places like that. So a lot of really important information. And it'd just be neat to know what kinds of stuff was there and what kinds of stuff didn't survive, and just to speculate about, gosh, what if this hadn't perished? What if it had been remembered? How could things have gone differently? Or, you know, where would the world, what course might culture have taken? Because, you know, Western culture is based so strongly on the Greeks.
Yeah.
And then the Romans building on the Greeks.
Yeah.
And that's not inevitable. I mean, that has created a very specific West, a very specific version of it. It could have gone a completely different way. And just imagine, you know, just imagine it. Or I like to imagine it. So the library is a place that I always think of. In fact, I was going to write a story once, and I might still do this, where, I've written stories about people that can visit many different versions of Earth.
Yeah.
And in one story, one of these travelers was going to reveal to a regular person that one thing they notice is that in every version of Earth, the library is gone, is destroyed. In every single one. And there's a certain chain reaction of events that happens from that that they can't seem to ever prevent. And so in my imagination, sometimes this is, I imagine sometimes that the collapse of this library is so much more significant than people realize, that had it not happened, things would be so different. And I guess I also imagine better, but, you know, maybe not, maybe worse. But it's just something that fascinates me to think about. So maybe that's one place I would go.
I hate those alternate realities that are just slightly different. Those always bother me.
What do you mean?
Like, well, Fringe has always been a great example of this, but those alternate realities where you have, like, versions of the same people in them.
Yeah.
Because it's like something changed, even the smallest thing, thousands of years ago, and yet you're trying to tell me you have the same person, they just have a different personality.
Right.
Like, I'm like, the very nature of society would be different.
Yeah,
you wouldn't have, like, the same building, but the symbol for the company was different. Like, really? Come on.
Well, and in for the United States, everybody who exists here now relies on migration patterns from clear across the ocean to have been a particular way.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you go back far enough and change something significant enough, those migration patterns are going to be very different. For example, if you go back far enough and you change things that prevent the potato famine from happening, because the potato famine happened not because there weren't enough variety of potatoes for people to be planting, but because the Irish, many of them were so poor, they gravitated toward a particular variety that was more hardy and would produce more, and so only one or two varieties were planted. But there were plenty of varieties, and if you change something in a way that the Irish were planting a huge variety of potatoes, and not just the Irish, but people all over Europe, yeah. The potato famine affected lots of people, but dozens of varieties from South America were available, that if people were planting all those varieties, then the famine would never have happened, and
immigration would have changed completely.
Yeah, a huge influx of immigrants would never have come.
But you don't even have to go back that far. Go back 50 years.
Well,
do some big event, and people aren't going to be in the same place at the same time. They're not going to meet the people that they end up marrying and having kids with. It's just stupid.
Do something so that World War II didn't happen.
There you go.
Now, that seems like a big thing, but
hell, do something that one major battle of World War II went differently.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, huge swaths of people don't exist.
That's
after
right.
That.
That's
like,
right.
And other people do.
That's exactly right. It's amazing the small changes that would make.
And yet, so many sci-fi shows. like ours right here. We're the alternate dimension, Tony and
that's
William.
Right.
Do you realize how bullshitty this is, people? Do you realize how stupid our own concept is?
No, but remember, our universe is exactly the same except evil.
Yes.
That's the only difference.
Which is weird when you think about it. Because if we do the exact same things, what about it makes it more evil? Just intent? Everything we do is with slightly more evil intent.
I don't know.
Will you marry me, but a little more evilly, you know?
Maybe that's all it takes.
Let's go out tonight and watch this movie a little more evilly.
Maybe that's all it takes. Maybe it's all about motivation.
Gonna have eggs for breakfast.
I do all the same things, but
I do it
for the wrong reasons. For example, right now, the reason I'm doing this... Now, William in the other universe does the podcast because he has great affection for Tony, and he loves to help him out, and he has great affection for the listeners. But in this universe, well, you know, there's something down the line I want to get from you, so this is all just a huge manipulation, see?
But it'll come out the same over there. Whatever it is you'll get from
that's
me
right.
then, too.
Except over there, he'll get it.
You weren't looking for it.
That's then. Right. Over there, you're reciprocating the affection because that's
you're
just
like,
a natural...
Oh, you shouldn't have.
But over here, you're caving into the manipulation. So it all looks the same on the surface.
It's very complicated. It's very, very complicated.
Well, it is when you think about it. It is kind of amazing how two things can look exactly the same on the surface, but underneath there's something.
One can be more evil.
Yeah, one is evil and one is actually
There
wrong.
Was a class, I didn't take it, in my college. Somebody did a class studying evil. I believe it was largely as a cultural phenomenon, but I would find that very interesting because I genuinely don't believe in good or evil, except as a cultural artifact, and so I find it very interesting. I feel like very seldom do people try and define evil.
They just accept whatever culture's told them it is.
Well, and they know it when they see it.
Well,
a phrase.
That's true.
But very seldom can they just sit there and think of it. And oftentimes, if they do that, they'll find that the models they've been using don't fit that definition.
Yeah, right.
At least not exactly.
Yeah, my perspective on evil is... I tend to think of it as something that...
takes pennies but does not leave them.
Well, that.
Yes.
But also something... it's really something that doesn't exist outside of us. I mean, it's a concept inside our being, I guess you could say. It's not really out here. Now, acts of destruction or harm. Now, that's something that's out here that can sometimes come from that place, hatred, you know, for example. But even then, we can always respond. Other people can always respond to those acts of harm or destruction in a way that doesn't reciprocate it or doesn't make it spread or doesn't make it greater. It's always a matter of personal choice. And so, for me, the existence of evil, it doesn't have a reality that's got the substance that most people tend to think it does. I mean, like you said, for you, good and evil doesn't exist outside the cultural thing. And for me, I think it's very similar. That's a kind of existence, but it's not.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, all things are.
Yeah, but it doesn't have the substance that a lot of people like to think it does. Now, but I don't think of good in the same way. I'm very, like a lot of the classic philosophers, good with a capital G. I think good is this thing that just is. That is interpreted and manifests itself in a lot of cultural ways, but I think that to me it's something that it's like truth and beauty and all these things. It's out there.
Then in that perspective, good and evil have no particular relationship in your definition.
That's exactly right, except in the sense of, you know, a person who perceives good as A, and they want to destroy it or diminish it, you know, that person might feel like they're taking it an evil position or an evil stance or what have you. But of course, who does that, right? I mean,
I do that.
Well, I suppose that's true.
And I would feel like I'm being evil, except that I.
But what that means is evil only has meaning in how it's compared to good. But good doesn't need to be compared to evil so that you will know what it is. Kind of like truth and what's true and false. When something's true and someone says, well, how do you know it's true? Well, you give them other truths that shore it up. Like if you say 2 + 2 = 4 and someone says, how do you know that? Well, you start explaining other truths about mathematics and logic and how this expression is used. You don't say, well, 2 + 5 = 4. You support truth with other truths. But if someone says 2 + 3 = 4, and you say, or is 2 + 3 = 4 is false, if they tell you it's false and you ask, well, explain why that's false, then again, what do they use? Truth. You use truth to explain truth, and you use truth to explain falsehood, but you never use falsehood to explain itself or truth. So falsehood only has meaning in how it's compared to truth, but truth can have its own intrinsic meaning without needing falsehood, and I think good and evil are the same way. In reality, I mean, philosophically speaking. Well,
that tired me out.
Sorry. Now, that's a very specific way of looking at good and evil, though. I mean, if you're just talking about, you know, some people would say, well, how can you know what feels good if you don't know what feels bad? Well, that's a little bit different. You know, and then you're talking about physiological, you're talking about experiences, and I can understand that idea.
Good is a moral, there's a moral thing versus a pleasurable thing. I mean, there are many uses of the word.
Yeah, exactly. And so you really have to know.
And generally speaking, you don't say that something feels good or something feels evil.
Well, that's true. But people often, you often hear people.
When you poked my finger with that knife, it felt evil. It felt really evil.
Well, but people often say, how can you know what's good without evil? And I think they're talking about something different than I was just talking about. I think that's a whole other level of, or whole other sense of what good and evil is. In the way I was talking about, I don't think it works like that. But, you know, as you're kind of implying by your response to all this, there's people can go round and around and talking about these things. And
well, I just never have spent much time on it. I have personal principles that fall into the camps of things I believe are required for me to live in this society. and things that I intrinsically prefer in terms of my treatment of others and others' treatment of me. I don't claim that they are what is right. I claim that they're what I like. You know, and that has to do a lot with issues of mutual respect for people and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are some things involving the law and stuff like that that I do because I feel that that is part of my responsibility as being part of this society. And that's the trade-off. It's not necessarily that, you know, all of the things being equal, I would just spontaneously decide to do this, but I'm living in the society. I'm getting the benefit of that. This is what I pay for it.
Right.
And that's pretty much it.
Yeah, and in all those
considerations, I don't often think about good or evil.
That's right, and for most people, I think that's true. For me, that's true. I mean, everything you're talking about, it's all.
I don't think most people feel that that's how they operate, though.
Oh well, maybe.
I think most people think that they're the good and evil thing, and they do the good things, and they do the evil.
Well, you're right. You often hear people,
and that it's somehow relatively universal.
Yeah, I think you're right that people think about it that way. In fact, you often hear people say, well, I'm a good person. And whenever they say that, I think, what do you mean by that? Because I would never say that about me.
I'm really bad at being a person.
I would never
say... I haven't got bipedal motion down. I have difficulty with my abstract communication tool use. I suck at...
Yeah, obviously that's not what they mean, but it almost sounds like that.
My sister-in-law
used to... I'm a good person.
Used to run a team-building company. And she'd do retreats and stuff. And there was this one bit that you would do with a piece of paper where you would have these little circles of what identifiers you had. So there'd be like, you know, husband.
Roles that you...
And brother. Yeah. And, you know, and accountant or what. The different roles you play within your life. And in the middle would just be you.
Mm-hmm.
And in each of them, you were supposed to rank from 1 to 10 how successful you thought you were in those roles. How well you did them.
Okay.
And the end point of the thing was supposed to be, and I never attended the thing, so I don't know, but the one that's just you as a person
mm-hmm.
is always, should say 10.
Well, yeah, who can be better at that
because,
than you?
Because, yes, you're being, and that's the thing, it's like being a good person. You're awesome at being a person, you know? You don't have gills, you know,
swinging trees.
Yeah, you have binocular often. Vision. You know, these kinds of things. Like, so yeah, it is a very weird.
Yeah, I don't even know. Yeah, people say this often, and I'm not sure what it means. But
I at least get it when people say they think they're being a good Christian. I'm like, I know what that is. There's a paradigm. I don't always agree with them.
I suppose,
but I know what
true.
That concept
I
means.
That's true. But yeah,
or you know, I'm being a good son or something like that. I get. Those. Well, but yeah, a good person is like...
Oh. Another thing about evil is that, you know, most people who do things that you don't like are not just deliberately being evil. That's that's a weird thing for people to think.
Well, that's a classic narrative thing that people have to realize is nobody ever thinks they're the villain.
Well, some people do, but very few people.
And those people tend to be crazy.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. But
no,
you know,
sane person generally thinks they're being,
you know,
the villain.
like Islamic extremists or whatever, as they're sometimes called. Really, we're just going to label them bad or evil, like they're something, like they're not human.
Yeah,
I mean,
nobody fucking hates our freedom, people.
Yeah, it's just
who hates freedom? That's the weirdest question ever.
Obviously, these people do what they do for a very specific reason, and probably reasons that if we took even a couple seconds to try and understand. We'd say, well, gosh, if we were in that position, we would do the same thing. In fact, I know we would. I mean, this is a point of American pride that,
if
anyone ever messed with me, I'd get my gun and I'd go out there.
I'm too lazy. I am a non-extremist in every culture.
Well, I understand that, but the fact of the matter is, we pride ourselves on being revolutionary and we're going to fight back and all this stuff. But then when someone else who feels oppressed does the same thing, we think they're evil? I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Now, maybe I'm not condoning what they're doing by any means.
No, it's fucked up.
And I still think they're wrong, but to say they're evil or to dehumanize them in some way and not try to understand why they're doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
Because if you don't understand why they're doing what they're doing, how are you going to help them stop doing it?
Not do it anymore, yes.
Not just by shooting them, because that seems to me that if they're already really angry and feel oppressed...
I'd be like, see?
Yeah, you're just giving them more reason to do it. So, I don't know, I'm as you know, I'm often baffled as to how people interpret these things and why they interpret them the way they do, but...
So you hear it here, people. William says, hug a terrorist.
No.
All right, we got to wrap this shit up.
You know what I mean.
But people should write into the hat. It's important.
Yeah.
Do it. TheMagicalTalkingHat@gmail.com. Email into it so that we have things to talk about, because as you can tell, we really have nothing to say unless we talk to you.
But thanks, Craig and Kia, for your...
Craig and Kia B. Also, go to the blog and tell us everything we got wrong or everything we got evil.
Yeah.
TheMagicalTalkingHat.com. It's a fun place. Hang out, chat, meet like-minded people, marry them, have babies, that kind of thing.
Or if you're Tony, don't have any babies.
No, don't have any babies if you're Tony. It's a rule. And we'll talk to you the next time those slackers screw around.
Yep.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Please disregard the previous hour of useless audio. This has been a production of the Magical Talking Hat Podcast. If you would like to contact us, and I don't know why you would, please do so at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. All music is provided courtesy of Jay Underberg. More of his PodSafe audio can be found at podsafeaudio.com/J_Underberg. Thank you.